Harper Audio presents Elizabeth is Missing by Emma Healy. Performed by Davina Porter. Prologue. Maud, was I boring you so much that you'd rather stand outside in the dark? A woman calls to me from the warm light of a cluttered dining room. My breath curls towards her, wet and ghostly, but no words follow. The snow, sparse but bright on the ground, reflects the light onto her face, which is drawn tight in an attempt to see. I know, though, that she can't see very well, even in the daylight. Come inside, she says. It's freezing. I promise I won't say another word about frogs and snails and majolica ware. I wasn't bored, I say, realizing too late that she's joking. I'll be there in a minute. I'm just looking for something. In my hand is the thing I've already found, still clotted with mud. A small thing, easily missed. The broken lid of an old compact, its silver tarnished, its navy blue enamel no longer glassy but scratched and dull. The mildewed mirror is like a window on a faded world, like a porthole looking out under the ocean. It makes me squirm with memories. What have you lost? The woman steps, precarious and trembling, out onto the patio. Can I help? I might not be able to see it, but I can probably manage to trip over it if it's not too well hidden. I smile, but I don't move from the grass. Snow has collected on the ridges of a shoeprint, and it looks like a tiny dinosaur fossil freshly uncovered. I clutch at the compact lid in my hand, soil tightening my skin as it dries. I've missed this tiny thing for nearly 70 years. And now the earth, made sludgy and chewable with the melting snow, has spat out a relic. Spat it into my hand. But where from? That's what I can't discover. Where did it lie before it became the gristle in the earth's meal? An ancient noise like a fox bark makes an attempt at the edges of my brain. Elizabeth, I ask, did you ever grow any summer squash? Chapter 1. You know there was an old woman mugged around here, Carla says, letting her long black ponytail snake over one shoulder. Well, actually, it was Weymouth, but it could have been here. So, you see, you can't be too careful. They found her with Arthur's face smashed in. This last bit is said in a hushed voice, but hearing isn't one of my problems. I wish Carla wouldn't tell me these things. They leave me with an uneasy feeling long after I've forgotten the stories themselves. I shudder and look out of the window. I can't think which direction Weymouth is in. A bird flies by. Have I got enough eggs? Plenty, so you don't have to go out today. She picks up the carer's folder, nodding at me, keeping eye contact until I nod back. I feel like I'm at school. There was something in my head a moment ago, a story, but I've lost the thread of it now. Once upon a time. Is that how it started? Once upon a time, in a deep, dark forest, there lived an old, old woman named Maud. I can't think what the next bit should be. Something about waiting for her daughter to come and visit, perhaps. It's a shame I don't live in a nice little cottage in a dark forest. I could just fancy that. And my granddaughter might bring me food in a basket. A bang, somewhere in the house, makes my eyes skitter across the sitting room. There's an animal. An animal for wearing outside, lying over the arm of the sofa. It's Carla's. She never hangs it up. Worried she'll forget it, I expect. I can't help staring at it, Sure it will move, scurry away to a corner, or eat me up and take my place. And Katie will have to remark on its big eyes, its big teeth. All these tins of peaches, Carla shouts from the kitchen. Carla, the carer. Carers is what they call them. You must stop buying food, she calls again. I can hear the scrape of tins against my formica worktop. You have enough for an army. Enough food? You can never have enough. Most of it seems to go missing anyway and can't be found even after I've bought it. I don't know who's eating it all. My daughter's the same. No more cans, Mum, she says, going through my cupboards at every opportunity. I think she must be feeding someone. Half the stuff disappears home with her, and then she wonders why I need to go shopping again. Anyway, it's not like I've many treats left in life. It's not like I have many treats left, I say, pushing myself higher in my seat to make my voice carry to the kitchen. Twists of shiny chocolate wrappers are wedged down the sides of the chair. They squirm against the cushions and I flick them away. My husband, Patrick, used to tell me off for eating sweets. I ate them a lot at home. It was nice to be able to have a sherbet lemon or a caramel cup when I wanted, as we weren't allowed them at the exchange. No one wants to speak to a telephonist who's got a mouthful. But he said they'd ruin my teeth. I always suspected he was more worried about my figure. Polo mints were our compromise, and I still like them. But now there's no one to stop me eating a whole box of toffees if I want them. I can even start first thing in the morning. It's morning now. I know, because the sun is on the bird table. It shines on the bird table in the morning and the pine tree in the evening. I have a whole day to get through before the light hits that tree. Carla comes, half crouching into the sitting room, picking up wrappers from around my feet. I didn't know you were here, dear, I say. I've done your lunch, she snaps off plastic gloves. It's in the fridge, and I've put a note on it. It's 9:40 now. Try not to eat it till 12, right? She talks as if I always gobble everything up as soon as she leaves. Have I got enough eggs? I ask, feeling suddenly hungry. Plenty, Carla says, dropping the carer's folder onto the table. I'm going now. Helen'll be here later, all right? Bye. The front door clicks shut, and I hear Carla locking it after her. Locking me in. I watch her through the window as she crunches across my path. She wears a coat with a fur-edged hood over her uniform. A carer in wolf's clothing. When I was a girl, I'd have been glad to have the house to myself, to eat things out of the larder and wear my best clothes, to play the gramophone and lie on the floor. Now I'd rather have the company. The light's been left on, and the kitchen seems like an empty stage set when I go in to rearrange my cupboards and check what Carla has left me for lunch. I half expect someone to come in. My mother with her shopping. Or Dad, with arms full of fish and chips, and say something dramatic like one of those plays at the Pier Theatre. Dad would say, "Your sister is gone." And there'd be a drum or a trumpet or something. And Ma would say, "Never to return." And we'd all stare at each other for the benefit of the audience. I pull a plate from the fridge, wondering what my line would be. The plate has a note attached. Lunch for Maud to eat after 12 p.m. I take the saran wrap off. It's a cheese and tomato sandwich. When I've finished eating, I wander back to the sitting room. It's so quiet in here, and my clock doesn't even tick out loud. It shows the time, though. And I watch the hands slowly moving round on top of the gas fire. I have hours of the day to fill, and at some point I have to switch on the TV. There's one of those sofa programs on. Two people on one sofa lean towards another person on the opposite sofa. They smile and shake their heads, and eventually the one on her own starts to cry. I can't work out what it's all about. Afterwards, there's a program where people run through various houses looking for things to sell. The sort of ugly things that are surprisingly valuable. A few years ago, I would have been appalled at myself watching TV in the day. But what else is there to do? I occasionally read, but the plots of novels don't make sense anymore, and I can never remember where I've left off. So I can boil an egg. I can eat an egg. And I can watch TV. After that, I'm just waiting. For Carla. For Helen. For Elizabeth. Elizabeth is the only friend I have left. The others are in homes or graves. She's a fan of these running about selling things programs and has a hope of one day finding a disregarded treasure. She buys all sorts of hideous plates and vases from charity shops, her fingers crossed for a fortune. Sometimes I buy her things too, bits of garish china mostly. It's a sort of game. Who can find the ugliest piece of pottery at the charity shop? Rather childish. But I've begun to find that being with Elizabeth, laughing with her, is the only time I feel like myself. I have an idea. There was something I had to remember about Elizabeth. Perhaps she wanted me to get her something. A boiled egg. Or some chocolate. That son of hers keeps her on starvation rations. He won't even spend money on new razors for himself. Elizabeth says his skin is raw from shaving, and she's worried he'll cut his own throat. Sometimes I wish he would. The miser. If I didn't pop round with the odd extra, she'd waste away. I've got a note here telling me not to go out, but I don't see why. It can't hurt to nip down to the shop. I write a list before I put on my coat, find my hat and keys, check I have the keys in the right pocket, and then check again at the front door. There are white stains along the pavement where snails have been flattened in the night. This street always collects hundreds of casualties after a rainy evening. But what makes those marks, I wonder? What part of the snail makes the stain turn white like that? Turn not pale, beloved snail, I say, bending over as far as I dare to get a better look. I can't think where the phrase is from, but it's possible it is about this very thing. I must try and remember to look it up when I get home. The shop isn't far, but I'm tired by the time I get there. And for some reason, I keep taking the wrong turning, which means I've got to walk back around the block again. I feel like I did at the end of the war. I often got lost on my way into town, what with houses bombed to rubble, and sudden open spaces, and roads blocked by bricks and masonry and broken furniture. It's a small place, Carrow's, crammed with things I don't want. I wish they'd move the rows and rows of beer cans to make space for something useful. It's always been here, though, ever since I was a child. They only changed the sign a few years ago. It's got Coca-Cola written on it now, and Carrow's is squashed in underneath like an afterthought. I read it out to myself as I go in, and then I read my shopping list aloud, standing by a shelf of boxes. Nutri-Grain and Cheerios, whatever they are. Eggs? Milk? Chocolate. I turn my bit of paper about to catch the light. There's a cosy, cardboardy smell in the shop, and it's like being in the larder at home. Eggs? Milk? Chocolate. Eggs? Milk? Chocolate. I say the words, but I can't quite think what the things look like. Could they be in any of the boxes in front of me? I carry on, muttering the list under my breath as I shuffle about the shop. But the words begin to lose meaning and are like a chant. I've got summer squash written down here too, but I don't think they sell them here.
Can I help, Mrs. Horsham?
Reg leans over the counter and his grey cardigan bags out, sweeping across the penny sweets in their plastic tub and leaving bits of fluff on them. He watches me walk round. Nosy beggar. I don't know what he's guarding. So I walked out with something once. So what? It was only a bag of soft lettuce. Or was it a jar of raspberry jam? I forget. Anyway, he got it back, didn't he? Helen took it back and that was that. And it's not as if he doesn't make mistakes. I've often been short on change over the years. He's been running this shop for decades, and it's time he retired. But his mother didn't give up working here until she was 90, so he'll probably hang on a bit longer. I was glad when the old woman finally gave up. She used to tease me whenever I came in, because I'd asked her to receive a letter for me when I was a girl. I'd written to a murderer, and I hadn't wanted the reply to go to my house, and I'd used a film star's name instead of my own. The reply never arrived, but Reg's mother thought I'd been waiting for a love letter and used to laugh about it long after I was married. What was it I came for? The loaded shelves frown down at me as I circle them, and the blue and white linoleum stares up, dirty and cracked. My basket is empty, but I think I've been here for a while. Reg is watching me. I reach for something. It's heavier than I was expecting, and my arm is pulled down suddenly with the weight. It's a tin of peach slices. That'll do. I put a few more tins in my basket, tucking its handles into the crook of my arm. The thin metal bars grind against my hip on the way to the counter.
Are you sure this is what you're after? Reg asks. Only you bought a lot of peach slices when you came in yesterday.
I look down into the basket. Is that true? Did I really buy the same things yesterday? He coughs, and I see a glint of amusement in his eyes. Quite sure, thank you, I say, my voice firm. If I want to buy peach slices, I can buy them. He raises his eyebrows and begins typing prices into his till. I keep my head high, watching the cans being put into the plastic carrying thing for carrying. But my cheeks are hot. What was it I came for? I feel in my pocket and find a piece of blue paper with my writing on it. Eggs? Milk? Chocolate. I pick up a bar of dairy milk and slip it into the basket, so at least I will have something from the list. But I can't put the peaches back now. Reg would laugh at me. I pay for my bag of cans and clank back down the road with them. It's slow going because the bag is heavier and my shoulder and the back of my knee are hurting. I remember when the houses used to whiz by as I walked, nearly running, to and from home. Ma would ask me afterwards about what I'd seen, whether certain neighbours were out, what I thought about someone's new garden wall. I'd never noticed. It had all gone past in a flash. Now I have plenty of time to look at everything, and no one to tell what I've seen. Sometimes when I'm having a sort through or a clear out, I find photos from my youth, and it's a shock to see everything in black and white. I think my granddaughter believes we were actually grey-skinned, with dull hair, always posing in a shadowed landscape. But I remember the town as being almost too bright to look at when I was a girl. I remember the deep blue of the sky and the dark green of the pines cutting through it, the bright red of the local brick houses, and the orange carpet of pine needles under our feet. Nowadays, though I'm sure the sky is still occasionally blue, and most of the houses are still there, and the trees still drop their needles, nowadays the colours seem faded, as if I live in an old photograph. When I get home, there's an alarm clock ringing. I set it sometimes to remind myself of appointments. I drop my bag inside the front door and turn off the alarm. I can't think what it's for this time. I can't see anything to tell me. Perhaps someone is coming. "Did the estate agent turn up?" Helen calls, her voice broken by the scrape of her key in the front door. "He was supposed to arrive at 12, did he?" "I don't know," I say. "What time is it now?" She doesn't answer. I can hear her clomping about in the hall. "Mum," she says, "where have these cans come from? How many bloody peach slices do you need?" I tell her I don't know how many. I tell her Carla must have brought them. I say I've been at home the whole day. And then I look at the clock, wondering how I've managed to get through it all. Helen comes into the sitting room, breathing out sweet, cold air. And I'm a child again, in my warm bed, and my sister's icy face presses against my cheek for a moment, and her chill breath whispers over me as she tells me about the pavilion and the dancing and the soldiers. Suki was always cold coming home from a dance, even in the summer. Helen is often cold too, from so much time spent digging about in other people's gardens. She holds up a plastic bag. "Why would Carla leave tins of peach slices in the hall?" She doesn't lower her voice, even though we're in the same room, and she holds the bag high off the ground. "You have to stop going shopping. I've told you I can get anything you need. I come every day." I'm sure I don't see her that often, but I'm not going to argue. Her arm drops, and I watch the bag swing to a stop against her leg. "So will you promise not to shop for food again?" "I don't see why I should. I told you, Carla must have brought them. And anyway, if I want to buy peach slices, I can buy them." The sentence has a familiar ring, but I can't think why. "If I were to grow some summer squash," I say, turning a shopping list to the light, "where would I best plant them?" Helen sighs her way out of the room, and I find I've got up to follow her. In the hall, I stop. There's a roaring noise coming from somewhere. I can't think what it is. I can't work out where it's coming from. But I can hardly hear it once I'm in the kitchen. Everything is very clean in here. My dishes are in the rack, although I don't think I put them there. And the knife and fork I like to use have been washed up. As I open a cupboard door, two scraps of paper flutter to the ground. One is a recipe for white sauce, and the other has Helen's name on it, a number underneath. I get a roll of sticking ribbon, long glue ribbon, out of a drawer to stick them back up again. Perhaps I will make a white sauce today, after I've had a cup of tea. I switch the kettle on. I know which plug it is, as someone has labelled it kettle. I get out cups and milk and a tea bag from a jar marked tea. There's a note by the sink. "Coffee helps memory." That one's in my handwriting. I take my cup through to the sitting room, pausing in the doorway. I've got this rumbling in my head, or perhaps it's coming from upstairs. I start up towards the landing, but I can't do it without holding on to both banisters. So I step back one and leave my tea on the shelf in the hall. I'll only be a minute. My room is quite sunny, and it's peaceful here, except for a sort of growl somewhere in the house. I push the door shut and sit at my dressing table by the window. Bits of costume jewellery are strewn across the doilies and china dishes. I don't wear proper jewellery now, except my wedding ring, of course. I've never had to have it altered, not in over 50 years. Patrick's matching one seemed to burrow itself into his flesh so that the knuckle bulged above it. He refused to have it cut off, and it wouldn't budge, however much butter I greased it with. He used to say the ring being bound to him like that was proof of a strong marriage. I used to say it was proof he didn't take care of himself properly. Patrick told me to be more worried about my own ring. Too loose on my slender finger, but really it fitted perfectly, and I never lost it. Helen says I lose my jewellery now, though she and Katie have taken most of the good pieces for themselves to keep them safe. I don't mind. At least they're still in the family, and none of it was very valuable. The most expensive thing I had was a bizarre gold pendant in the shape of Queen Nefertiti's head, which Patrick brought back from some building project in Egypt. I push my hand through a dingy sort of plastic bangle and look in the mirror. My reflection always gives me a shock. I never really believed I would age, and certainly not like this. The skin around my eyes and the bridge of my nose has wrinkled in a very unexpected way. It makes me look quite lizard-like. I can hardly remember my old face, except in flashes. A round-cheeked girl in front of the mirror taking out her curlers for the first time. A pale young woman in the pleasure gardens looking down into the green river. A tired mother with untidy hair, half-turned from the dark window of a train as she tries to pull apart her fighting children. I'm always frowning in my memory, so no wonder my brow has set that way. My mother had smooth peaches and cream skin right to her death, though she had good reason to be more wrinkled than most. Perhaps it was something to do with not wearing makeup. They say that about nuns, don't they? I don't wear makeup either these days, and I've never worn lipstick, never liked it. The girls at the exchange teased me about it, and every now and then, when I was young, I'd try some out, borrow a friend's, or use one I'd been given for Christmas. But I could never stand to have it on for more than a few minutes. I've got a tube in the drawer from Helen, or Katie, and I take it out now, twisting the base and applying it very carefully, leaning close to the mirror, making sure not to get it on my teeth. You see these old women with flecked dentures and sooty eyelids, and rouge smeared over their faces, their eyebrows drawn on too high? I'd rather die than be one of them. I blot my lips together. Nice and bright now, but slightly cracked. And I am quite thirsty. About time I made myself a cup of tea. I drop the lipstick back in the drawer and slip a long pearl necklace over my head before getting up. Not real pearls, of course. When I open my door, I can hear a roaring noise. I can't think what it is. It gets louder the further down the stairs I go. I stop on the bottom step, but I can't see anything. I look into the sitting room. The roaring is even louder. I wonder if it's in my head. If something is coming loose. The noise swells and vibrates. And then it stops. There. That's your vacuuming done anyway. Helen stands by the dining room door, winding up the wire on the vacuum cleaner. Her mouth wavers into a smile. Are you going out somewhere? She asks. No, I say. I don't think so. What are the pearls for, then? You're all dolled up. Am I? I lay a hand against my collarbone. I've got a string of pearls on, and a thing on my wrist, and I can taste lipstick. Lipstick, with its fetid waxen smell and its suffocating thickness. I wipe the back of my hand over my mouth, but that only smears it and makes it worse. So I begin to scrub at my face, pulling the sleeve of my cardigan down to act as a flannel, spitting on it, and rubbing as if I were both mother and mucky child. It's some minutes before I feel clean again, and I find Helen has been watching me. "Give me your cardigan," she says. "I'd better put it in the wash." She asks if I want something to drink. "Oh, yes," I say, shrugging the wool from my skin and dropping onto my chair. "I'm terribly thirsty." "No wonder," Helen says, turning to leave the room. There was a line of cold cups of tea on the shelf in the hall. I say I can't think how they got there,
but I don't think she hears me because she's already disappeared into the kitchen. And anyway, my head is lowered as I'm going through my handbag. I had some malted biscuits in here at some point. Was it yesterday? Did I eat them? I take out a comb and my purse and some scrunched-up tissues. I don't find any biscuits, but there is a note in one of the bag's pockets. No more peach slices. I don't tell Helen. Instead, I put it under the note with today's date. My carer leaves me one like that every day. That's how I know it's Thursday. I usually visit my friend Elizabeth on a Thursday, but we don't seem to have made any arrangement this week. She hasn't called. I'd have written it down if she had. I'd have made a note of what she'd said, or some of it. I'd have written down what time to go and see her. I write everything down. There are bits of paper all over the house, lying in piles or stuck up on different surfaces. Scribbled shopping lists and recipes, telephone numbers and appointments, notes about things that have already happened. My paper memory. It's supposed to stop me forgetting things. But my daughter tells me I lose the notes. I have that written down too. Still, if Elizabeth had called, I'd have a note. I can't have lost everyone. I write things down over and over. They can't all have dropped off the table and the worktop and the mirror. And then I have this piece of paper tucked into my sleeve. No word from Elizabeth. It has an old date on one side. I have a horrible feeling something has happened to her. Anything could have. There was something on the news yesterday, I think, about an old woman. Something unpleasant. And now Elizabeth's disappeared. What if she's been mugged and left for dead? Or had a fall and can't get to a phone? I think of her lying on the floor of her sitting room, unable to get up, still hoping for some treasure to leap from the carpet. Perhaps you've spoken to her and don't remember, Mum. Do you think that might be possible? Helen hands me a cup of tea. I'd forgotten she was here. She bends to kiss me on the top of my head. I feel her lips through the thin hair that puffs from my scalp. She smells of some sort of herb. Rosemary, perhaps. I suppose she was planting some. For remembrance. Because, well, you did forget that we'd been out on Saturday, didn't you? I balance the cup on the arm of the chair, keeping a hand on it. I don't look up when my daughter moves back. I suppose she must be right. I have no recollection of Saturday, but I have no recollection of not recalling it either. The thought makes me breathe in sharply. These blanks are worrying. More than worrying. How can I not remember last Saturday? I feel the familiar skipping of my heartbeat, the flush of embarrassment, fear. Last Saturday. Can I even remember yesterday? So perhaps you've spoken to Elizabeth. I nod and take a sip of tea, already losing the train of the conversation. You're probably right. I'm not quite sure what I'm agreeing to, but I like the feeling of falling into blankness. The end of anxiously trying to remember. Helen smiles. Is there a hint of triumph in it? All right, then. I better get going. Helen is always going. I watch her through the front window as she gets into her car and drives off. I can never remember her arriving. Perhaps I should write it down. But these bits of paper on the table beside my chair, this system for remembering, it's not perfect. So many of the notes are old. No longer relevant, and I get them muddled. And even the new ones don't seem to contain the right information. There's one here with writing still shiny. Haven't heard from Elizabeth.
I ran my fingers over the words, smudging them slightly. Is that true? I must only just have written it. I certainly can't remember having heard from her recently. I reach for the phone. Button number 4 is Elizabeth. It rings and rings. I make a note. Chapter 2. Elizabeth is missing, I say. Did I tell you? I am looking at Helen, but she isn't looking at me. You said. What are you going to eat? I sit staring over the top of my menu. God knows where we are. I can see it's a restaurant. Waiters in black and white. Marble-topped tables. But which one? I have an awful feeling I'm supposed to know and that this is some kind of treat. I don't think it's my birthday, but perhaps an anniversary. Patrick's death? It would be just like Helen to remember and make it a special occasion. But I can see from the bare trees out on the street that it's the wrong time of year. Patrick died in the spring. The menu says the olive grill. It's heavy, the cover leathery. I trace the indented letters with a finger, though the name means nothing to me, and the end of the spine slips on the tabletop. I pull it onto my lap and read the contents aloud. French onion soup, tomato and mozzarella salad, garlic mushrooms, parma ham and melon. Yeah, thanks, Mum, Helen says. I can read it myself. She doesn't like me reading things out. It causes her to sigh and roll her eyes. Sometimes she makes gestures behind my back. I've seen her in mirrors, pretending to strangle me. What are you going to have? She asks now, lowering the menu but keeping her eyes on it. Chorizo stuffed summer squash, I read, unable to stop myself. Is squash fashionable again, then? I haven't seen one on a menu for years. People used to grow summer squash more when I was young, and there were competitions for the best ones. That doesn't seem to happen so much now. I got to know Elizabeth because of some summer squash. The first time I met her, she told me her garden wall had pebbles cemented to the top, and I knew exactly where she lived. It was the house with the garden, where more than 60 years ago, some squash had been dug up during the night. And I don't know why, but I wanted to have a look in that garden, so I got myself invited round for tea. You won't like chorizo, Helen says. What about the soup? I used to have soup with Elizabeth, I say, feeling a sort of ticklishness at the thought. After we'd finished at the charity shop, soup and sandwiches, and the Daily Echo crossword. We haven't done that in a long time, and I still haven't heard from her, not a word. I can't understand it. She never goes away. Something must have happened. Mum, you've got to order. A waiter is standing by our table, notepad out ready. I wonder how long he's been there. He bends right over to ask us what we want, his face unnecessarily close to mine. I lean away from him. Helen, you haven't heard anything about Elizabeth, have you? I say. You would tell me if you had. Yes, Mum. What are you going to eat? I mean, it's not like she can go off on holiday. I close the menu and look for somewhere to rest it, but I can't find a space. There are things in the way. Shiny things, like Elizabeth has. I can't think what they are. They stand on her table, alongside Branston pickle and salad cream and bags of Maltesers. The bags are usually open and the chocolates roll out onto the floor like some sort of cartoonish trap. I often worry about her slipping on one. If she'd had a fall, I wouldn't know, I say. I doubt her son would bother to tell me. The waiter straightens up and takes the menu from my hands. Helen smiles at him and orders for us both. I don't know what. He nods and wanders off, still writing. past walls streaked with black paint.
The side plates are black too. I suppose that must be fashionable.
The restaurant is like a sheet of smudged newsprint, one that's been scrunched round an apple for the winter,
unreadable except for the advertisements.
There's no way of finding anything out for yourself. That's the problem, I say, feeling a sudden lift as I unexpectedly catch hold of my subject. Families are informed, but not friends. Not at our age, anyway. This used to be the chop house. Do you remember, Mum? Helen breaks in. What was I saying? I can't remember. Something. Do you remember? I'm blank. You used to meet Dad here, didn't you? I look around the room. There are two old women at a table by a paint-streaked wall. They peer at something lying flat on the table between them. Elizabeth is missing, I say. When it was the chop house? For lunch? Her phone rings and rings. The chop house, remember? Oh, never mind. Helen sighs again. She's doing a lot of that lately. She won't listen, won't take me seriously. Imagines that I want to live in the past. I know what she's thinking, that I've lost my marbles, that Elizabeth is perfectly well at home, and I just don't remember having seen her recently. But it's not true. I forget things, I know that, but I'm not mad. Not yet. And I'm sick of being treated as if I am. I'm tired of the sympathetic smiles and the little pats people give you when you get things confused. And I'm bloody fed up with everyone deferring to Helen rather than listening to what I have to say. My heartbeat quickens and I clench my teeth. I have a terrible urge to kick Helen under the table. I kick the table leg instead. The shiny salt and pepper shakers rattle against each other and a wine glass starts to topple. Helen catches it. Mum, she says, be careful. You'll break something. I don't answer. My teeth are still tight together. I feel I might start screaming, but breaking something, that's a good idea. That's exactly what I want to do. I pick up my butter knife and stab it into the black side plate. The china breaks. Helen says something, swearing, I think, and somebody rushes towards me. I keep looking at the plate. The middle has crumbled slightly, and it looks like a broken record. A broken gramophone record. I found some once in our back garden. They were in the vegetable patch, smashed to bits and jumbled together. Ma had sent me out to help Dad when I'd got back from school, and he'd handed me his shovel for digging a runner bean trench before disappearing into the shed. The records were almost the same colour as the soil, and I wouldn't have found them, only I felt something snap as I dug, and a few moments later the shards caught between the prongs of my garden fork. When I realised what they were, I scraped them out of the earth and dropped them into a sunny patch of grass to dry. I couldn't think where they'd come from. Only Douglas, our lodger, had a gramophone, and I thought he'd have said if any of his records had broken. Anyway, he was a nice boy and wasn't the sort to dump things in the garden. What on earth are they? Ma said as she came out to collect some washing and found me kneeling over the pieces. I'd brushed the dirt off and begun to fit them back together. Not because I thought the records would ever play again, but because I wanted to see which ones they were. Ma rubbed at the dirty marks on my face where I'd tried to brush my hair away with soil-covered fingers, and said she thought it must be the neighbours who'd chucked the records over the fence. "There's a new tenant every week next door. Heaven knows who they are at the moment," she said. "It's not the first time I've found rubbish out here." She looked down at the black parodies of discs. "Fancy breaking all these. Good for nothing now. Hey, Maud, toss them in the bottom of the runner bean trench for drainage." "All right," I said. I just want to put them together first.
Why? You making stepping stones for the lawn?
Could I?
Don't be daft.
She laughed and stepped daintily from one broken bit to another, the washing basket on her hip, till she was at the kitchen door. I watched her go in, the red of her hair dull against the bright red brick of our house. It didn't take me long to connect the pieces, and it was nice work in the winter sun, listening to the music of the pigeons as they cooed to one another. It was like doing a jigsaw puzzle, except that even when I'd finished there were still some bits missing. I could read the labels now, though. Virginia, we three, and I'm nobody's baby. I sat back on my heels. These were my sister's favourites, the ones she always asked Douglas to play. And now, here they were, smashed up and buried amongst the remains of rhubarb and onions. I couldn't think who would do it or why. I shuffled the bits together again, scattering them into the bean trench. And when I walked back to the house, I saw Douglas staring at his window. I thought for a moment he was staring down at me, but then a flurry of birds dived from the dark of the hedge, and I turned just in time to catch the shape of a woman scurrying away. "I have to pick Katie up in less than half an hour," Helen says, getting her coat on, despite the fact that I'm still finishing my ice cream. It's nice and cold against my tongue, but I can't work out what flavour it's meant to be. Strawberry, I suppose, from the colour. I'll need the loo, too, before we go. I wonder where the ladies is. I wonder if I've been to this restaurant before. It reminds me of the lovely old chop house that Patrick and I used to meet in when we were courting. It wasn't expensive, didn't have exotic food or white tablecloths, but everything was nicely cooked and well laid out. I used to walk down from the exchange at lunchtime and wait at a table by the window. Patrick would get a tram from the pier where his firm were working on plans for rebuilding, and he'd come loping along, hair swept about and cheeks red, and he'd grin as soon as he saw me. No one grins at me like that now. "Do you need the loo, Mum?" Helen's holding my coat out for me. "No. No, I don't think so." "Okay, then, let's go." She's not very pleased with me. I've obviously done something. Was it embarrassing? Did I say something to the waiter? I don't like to ask. I told a woman once that her teeth made her look like a horse. I remember Helen telling me I'd said it, but I don't remember saying it. "Are we going home?" I ask instead. "Yes, Mum." The sun went down while we were eating, and the sky is an inky colour. But I can still see the road signs through the car's windscreen, and am reading them aloud before I know it. "Give way. Level crossing. Reduce your speed." Helen's hands go white on the steering wheel. She doesn't speak to me. I shift in my seat, suddenly aware of my full bladder. "Are we going home?" Helen sighs. This means I've asked before. As we turn onto my street, I realise how urgent my need to go is. I can't wait any longer. "Drop me here," I say to Helen, scrabbling at the door handle. "Don't be silly, we're nearly there now." I open the door anyway and Helen stops the car with a jerk. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" she says. I scramble out of the car and make off down the road. "Mom!" Helen calls, but I don't turn round. I hurry towards my door, body bent forward. Every few seconds an extra hard squeeze of the muscles is required. The pressure in my bladder seems greater the closer I come to home, and I unbutton my coat as I walk, groping desperately for my key. At the door I shift from foot to foot, frantically twisting the key in the lock. Something is stopping it from turning properly. "Oh, no, oh, no," I moan aloud. Finally, I feel it catch and turn. I fall through the door and slam it behind me, handbag thudding to the floor. Clawing at the banister, I rush up the stairs, coat sailing away as I shrug it off. but I get to the bathroom too late. Hand on my waistband, I start to wee. I tear down my trousers, but have no time for the rest, and so sit on the loo, urinating through my cotton knickers. For a few moments, I let myself slump forward, head on hands, elbows on knees, the sodden trousers clinging round my ankles. Then, slowly and awkwardly, I kick off my shoes and pull the thick, wet fabric over my feet, dropping it into the bath. There are no lights on in the house. I couldn't stop to switch any on. And so I sit in the dark and begin to cry.
The thing is to be systematic. Try to write everything down. Elizabeth is missing, and I must do something to find out what's happened.
But I'm so muddled. I can't be sure about when I last saw her or what I've discovered.
I've phoned, and there's no answer. I haven't seen her,
I think.
She hasn't been here, and I haven't been there.
What next?
I suppose I should go to the house, search for clues, and whatever I find, I will write it down. I must put pens into my handbag now. The thing is to be systematic. I've written that down too. I check that I have my key 3 times before I move off the doorstep. The pale sunlight slants onto the lawn beside me as I shuffle along the path, and the smell of the pine trees makes me feel optimistic. I don't think I've been out for a few days. Something happened and Helen has been fussing. But it's all a blank, which makes me feel dizzy. I've wrapped up warm in a suede duffel coat, over a knitted sweater, over a wool dress, but I'm still chilly. I go past Carrow's and catch sight of myself in the window. Back hunched, I look like a tortoise ambling along without a racing hare to spur me on. As I walk, I check the pens in my bag and the paper in my pockets. Another quick check every few steps. The most important thing is to write everything down. For a moment, I'm hazy about just what it is I have to write, but the route I'm following reminds me. Past the last of the prefabs, which has been painted a sickly green and yellow by its owner. Elizabeth laughs at its ugliness and says if she could find a ceramic replica, it would be worth a fortune. Then the back of a hotel, where the road is slick with a murky liquid. Elizabeth says it's the tea dregs that are thrown out after breakfast. And under the beautiful acacia tree, stretching from a snail-covered front garden. Elizabeth's taken cuttings every year, but they always fail. Elizabeth's house is white-painted with double-glazed windows. The net curtains give it away as being the home of a pensioner, though, of course, I can hardly criticise having them myself. It was built just after the war, finished in 1946, as part of a street of new homes, and the garden wall has never been changed. The first owner cemented coloured pebbles to the top, and no one has ever removed them. Elizabeth wouldn't dream of having them chipped off now. I was always curious about these new houses as a girl, and I remembered this one especially because of the pebbled wall. I ring the bell. It echoed through the empty house. The phrase bubbles up from somewhere, but bells always echo through houses, surely. Empty or not. I wait and work a hand deep into one of the earth-filled barrels by the front step. These are usually crammed with flowers, but not even a green shoot breaks the surface now. Elizabeth must have forgotten to plant any bulbs this year. I pull my hand out quickly. I can't think what it was doing in the soil. Was I just feeling for bulbs, or am I supposed to be looking for something else? I face the door, wondering how long I've waited here. 5 minutes? 10? I check my watch, but it doesn't give me any clues. Time is so elastic now.
I ring the bell again, carefully making a note of the time, and then watch the second hand as it moves round. After 5 minutes, I write, "No sign of Elizabeth," and begin to walk away. Perhaps she is on holiday, as someone suggested. Or is staying with her son? But I would have written that down, I'm sure of it. I keep old notes like that. These little snippets of news are things to talk about, as well as information for myself. "Do you know Elizabeth's gone off to the south of France?" I might say to Helen. Or, "Elizabeth staying with that son of hers," I could tell Carla. News of that kind is valuable. Helen has been known to stay an extra 30 seconds for it in the past. So I know I'm not forgetting this time. Elizabeth must be missing. But all I've established so far, all I've proved, is that she is not at home this minute. At the gate I have a thought, and I turn back to look in through the front window. Pressing my nose against the cool glass and cupping my hands round the top of my head, I can just see through the net curtains. They give the dark room a misty quality, but I can make out the empty chairs and plumped cushions. Her books have been pushed neatly into their shelves, and her collection of majolica pots and vases and tureens stand in a line on the mantelpiece. "You never know," Elizabeth always says, after she's done laughing at my reaction to the veiny ugliness of a moulded leaf, or the sick, makingly intricate scales of a fish. "One of them might be worth a fortune." She can't see the things properly, of course, only a vague brightness of the colours, but she likes the feel, the animals and insects in relief. She can trace the contours where they rise from the surface of the pottery, the glaze almost as smooth as a frog's skin, almost as slippery as an eel's. She lives in hope of discovering one that's really rare. And the promise of money is the only reason her son allows her to keep them. Otherwise, they'd be in the wheelie bin without a word. I take out a thick pen and a bright yellow square of paper ready to articulate my meagre findings. Very tidy. No Elizabeth, no lights on. Backing away, I stumble into a flower bed and my foot sinks into the soil, leaving a perfect print of my shoe. Good thing I'm not planning anything criminal. I walk carefully round the edge of the bed to the side of the house and look in through the kitchen window. There are no net curtains here, and I can clearly see the bare wooden worktops and gleaming sink. "No food out in kitchen," I write. "No bread, no apples, no washing up." It's not much, but it's something. I walk back home through the park. It's not raining, so I may as well get some fresh air. The grass is slightly frosty, and I enjoy feeling it crunch under my feet. Somewhere on the other side of the bandstand is a dip, like a meteor crater filled with flowers and benches. Helen did that. It was one of her first big commissions, and though I don't recall all the details, I do remember they had to move tons of soil. It's a deliberate sun trap, and even tropical flowers thrive there. She was always good at making things grow. And she would know the best place to plant summer squash. I must remember to ask her when I see her next. I've been walking past this bandstand for 70-odd years. My sister and I used to come this way when we went to the pictures. They often had music on here during the war to cheer everyone up. The deck chairs would be out and filled with men in khaki uniforms, hardly camouflaged against the bright grass. Suki would slow down to hear the band and smile at the soldiers. She always knew one or two from dances at the pavilion. I'd run back and forth between her and the gates, wanting to get into town, impatient to see whichever film it was we were heading for. I wish I could run like that now, but I wouldn't have the breath. At the steps out of the park, I pause to look back. The sky has darkened, and a figure kneels on the grass. The sound of a boy calling to someone from the bandstand makes me hurry, shivering, towards the street. On the third step down, there's a shiny bit of stone. My foot slips. I try to grab at the handrail, but miss it. My nails scrape along the brick wall, and my handbag swings wide, pulling me with it. I land, heavily on my side, clenching my jaw muscles at the pain in my arm. Blood rushes about my body as if it doesn't know where it should be, and I find I'm staring and staring, eyelids stretched wide, eyes drying. Slowly the shock of it recedes and I can blink again, but I'm too tired to get up at once, so I roll over and rest where I am for a minute. I can see the rusty underside of the railing, and beneath that some gritty-looking paint which has been stenciled into the shape of a fox. There's soil in the creases of my palm, although I can't think where it's from, and the sharp juts of the steps dig into my back. At least I have finally fallen. These steps have always been a worry, and I haven't hit my head, though I've bashed my side and my elbow, and will have bruises tomorrow. I can feel them spreading under my skin, staining me like blackberry juice. I remember the pleasure of studying my bruises as a child, the black and navy of them, the cloud-like shapes they made. I was always finding blotches on my hip from knocking into furniture, or purplish fingernails from getting my fingers caught in the laundry mangle. Once, my friend Audrey slipped while she was mucking about, hanging over the edge of the east cliff, and I got a dark line across my chest from smashing into the railings when I grabbed her. And then there were the marks left by the madwoman after she chased me home. I'd been sent out for groceries, and I found her at the counter. She was mumbling something to the grocer as I asked for a tin of peaches and Ma's ration of cooking fat, and I stood away from her while the things were being weighed and wrapped, looking into a high corner of the shop. There was a strange aniseed smell, and somehow I felt it was coming from the madwoman, though perhaps it was just the jars of licorice which stood along the windowsill. I paid and left, and was holding the groceries against my chest, waiting for a tram to pass, when suddenly there was a great bang on my shoulder. My heart jumped and my breath whistled in my throat. It was her. She had followed me out and hit me with her umbrella. She always carried an umbrella, a shabby, inky thing, half unfurled in a way that made it look like an injured bird. She used to stop the buses by standing in front of them and waving the umbrella. Then she would lift her dress and show her knickers. They said it was because her daughter had been knocked down and killed by a bus before the war. People talked about it in whispers, or they made sly jokes. But if you asked a question, you'd be told to be quiet, not to pry. Just to keep away from her, as if she had something catching. The end of the tram was trundling away at last when, bang, she hit me again. I leapt across the road. She followed. I ran up my street, dropping the tin of peaches in panic, and she chased me, shouting something I couldn't catch. I got through the kitchen door, calling for my mother, and she rushed out to see the woman off and retrieve the peach slices. I've always told you, don't look at her, don't talk to her, keep your distance, Ma said when she came back in. I told her I'd done all that, and she'd still chased me. Well, I've never seen her in the grocer's before. We should probably fetch a policeman, but I can't help feeling sorry for her. I suppose she doesn't like seeing young girls about the place, Ma said, peering out of the window in case the woman was still about. Because of her daughter being killed by that bus. My fault for being a young girl, I thought. But I wondered later if she'd just been hungry and had wanted my rations. There was a bruise on my shoulder for weeks after that, dark against my pale skin. It was the same colour as the mad woman's umbrella. as if it had left a piece of itself on me. A feather from a broken wing. Chapter 3 I've rung the doctor. Carla told me not to, but I've got a very sore arm. I think it might be a symptom of something more worrying. She says it's just the way old people are in the morning. She doesn't use the words old people, but I know that's what she means. When she realizes I've rung the doctor anyway, she calls my daughter to come and tell me off. For God's sake, Mum, you've been asked to leave the poor man alone, Helen says, sitting on the window seat, looking out for him. But Helen, I'm ill, I say. I think I'm ill. That's what you said last time, but there's nothing wrong with you. You're just not young any more. The doctor can't do anything about that. Oh, here he is now. She leaps up from the seat and goes to open the front door. They talk in the hall, but I can't catch what they say.
Well, Mrs. Horsham, he says, coming into the room, winding up the earphones to a Walkman, or whatever they are now. I'm rather hard-pressed this morning. What did you want to see me about?
He's young, my doctor. Very young and very handsome, with dark hair falling over his forehead. I smile at him, but he doesn't smile back. I'm all right, I say. What's the fuss? He breathes out through his nose, an impatient sound, like a foraging animal.
You called the surgery, Mrs. Horsham. You said you were in urgent need of a house call.
He looks at Helen, then sits down, holds my wrist in his hand, and presses it, looking at his watch.
Can you remember what it was about? He says. You've been ringing fairly frequently of late. And people don't usually ask for house calls when they are all right.
Helen shakes her head at me behind him. I haven't been calling frequently, I say, still looking at Helen.
That's not quite true, is it?
He says, scribbling something on a notepad.
In fact, you phoned us 12 times in the last fortnight.
12 times? He must have me confused with somebody else. The wires must have been crossed, or perhaps the telephonist put the wrong person through.
No, I'm not suggesting you're making things up, really I'm not. But I wonder whether there isn't something else going on here.
He takes out a little flashlight.
Perhaps it's not something strictly medical.
I'm sorry, I say, turning from the light, which is like a fly buzzing in my face. But I really don't think it can have been me who phoned all those times. I usually have very good health.
I know you do,
he says, putting a hand on my forehead so I can't move away, and pointing the flashlight at one of my eyes.
Which is why it's a little frustrating to be called out by you when I have genuinely ill people to see.
I don't know what to think. I can't concentrate with this light flicking over my skin. But he tells me I must open my eyes. I don't understand it, I say. I'm not like my friend Elizabeth. She can barely leave the house. Her sight's poor and she's unsteady on her feet, whereas I...
Whereas you are in great shape for your age, I know.
He puts the flashlight away and I frown at him. For a minute, I can't think what he's here for. But I meant to tell you, Doctor, I say. My friend Elizabeth. She's missing.
Oh, Mum, don't start that again.
Helen jumps in.
Sorry, it's a bit of an obsession of hers at the moment. I've told her I'll find out what's happened.
It's not an obsession. I don't know how long she's been gone.
I'm sure your friend will be in touch. You must relax and let her family take care of her, okay?
Relaxing is the key.
Right, I must get to my other patients.
He picks up his bag and turns to Helen.
I see she's had a blood test this week, too.
There is a brief look at me.
You might want to arrange for a faculties assessment at some point. He is already inserting the little plugs, the wire shells, back into his ears while he talks on to Helen. And I wonder briefly what it is he listens to. I cup my hands over my own ears, straining to hear the sea-like music of my circulation, the singing of my blood. But hands don't work as well as shells. They don't create the right echo, or whatever it is. Helen comes back after letting the doctor out and sits on the arm of my chair. "You didn't have to cover your ears, Mum," she says. "He wasn't shouting." "But now will you promise not to phone the surgery again? And to stop all this nonsense about Elizabeth?" I don't answer. "Mum!" She grabs my arm, and I cry out. "What's the matter?" she says, pulling back my sleeve. There are bruises staining my skin, spreading round the elbows, fanning out like wings. "My God! Why didn't you tell the doctor about this? I'll call him and ask him to come back." "No, don't," I say. "I can't stand that fly in my face. I don't want him here again." "I'm sorry." Helen slides down into a crouching position in front of me. She holds my hand. "I'm sorry I didn't believe you. I'm sorry I didn't tell the doctor to look at you properly." "How did you get these bruises, Mum?" "It was an umbrella," I say. "But really, I can't remember." She sits, stroking my hand for a few minutes, and I close my fingers over hers, feeling the skin around her nails where it's pink and raw from scrubbing soil away. This is the closest we've been in a long time. "I sat and held my mother's hand when she was dying," I say, though I meant to keep the thought to myself.
"You're not dying?"
"I know. But it reminded me, that's all. She died never knowing. I don't want to die like that."
Helen sits up a little. "Never knowing what, Mum?"
"About Suki." I clutch at her fingertips. "So that's why I want to find Elizabeth."
Helen sighs and drops my hand. "I'd better go soon. Can I get you anything?"
I tell her there's nothing I need,
and then change my mind.
"I'd like a new sweater." One of the last times Elizabeth went shopping before her sight got too bad, before she stopped going out of the house, she bought me a silk glasses case. I notice it whenever I open my handbag. The pale silk catches the light, and the coolness of the material reminds me of its presence whenever I get my money or feel for my bus pass. I keep my spare pair of glasses in it. I only really need glasses for reading, but they make you wear them all the time once you reach a certain age. It's part of the uniform. How would they know you were an old duffer otherwise? They want you to have the right props so they can tell you apart from people who have the decency to be under 70. False teeth, hearing aid, glasses. I've been given them all. Helen always makes sure I have them before we leave the house. She stops short of checking I have my teeth in, but she makes a special point about the glasses. I think she thinks I'll start bumping into things if I forget them. So I always have one pair on a chain around my neck, ready for any reading eventuality. They're not helping much at the moment. I'm looking for a sweater. A nice, sensible colour and thin wool.